Good to be here. Always good to be back here, especially when Rodney's here. Well, maybe if we get some pig bellies before then, we can do that. We got Rodney one time. We invited him over to eat when we were newly married and cooked soup for him. And it smelled good. He came in, oh, it smells good. It smells very good. He ate, and my wife just keeps smiling. And he thinks, why does she keep smiling about this soup? And after he'd eaten about two or three bowls, he said, this is just great soup, Kiki. What is it? And she's like, it's pig stomach and chicken soup. And he wasn't as happy after he heard that as he was eating it. But he's never let me go past that in trust. So, well, good to be here. Always good to come back and see y'all. Mormonism is a topic that really the more you dig into it, the more you want to say, but then the more you shouldn't say. You kind of have to back up and just go from the least common denominator of what do most of them hold. So I'm sure you've heard stories of secret rituals and this and that. What I've tried to do is just take what can Mormons agree on and what can we agree on as this is what they hold and present it from that way. Now, we will get into more deeper and controversial issues as we move through this, but tonight I just want to go through basic what is Mormonism. And so the next slide is going to just show how we're going to go through this. Day one, we're going to go over the history of where Mormonism came from, who started it, where they started it, and kind of how it progressed for the first few decades of its life. And the Book of Mormon. What is the Book of Mormon? Had a guy just this morning when I went to pick up some of my notes at church. He's our church administrator. And he was telling me, he said, I have a copy of the Book of Mormon. And he was showing it to me. A girl had given it to him one time. And I said, do you know where that book took place? And he said, no, I have no idea where it took place. And I said, well, if I told you it took place in Central America, would you think that was incredible? He said, what are Jewish people doing in Central America? Exactly. You know, that's when you get into what is the Book of Mormon. But this is all stuff we can agree on, they can agree on. I'm not doing anything that's controversial yet. Now, day two, distinctive beliefs and Joseph Smith. What do they believe that is distinctly Mormon? If you ask a Mormon what do they believe, what will they say? And who was Joseph Smith as far as good evidence can ascertain? Then day three, salvation and the afterlife. What do they believe about salvation and what do they believe about the afterlife? You know, I could just tell you now to kind of tease you into coming back for day three, but it would be better to be Hitler in Mormonism than an ex-Mormon. The way that their heaven, earth, hell are set up, it's better to be Adolf Hitler than an ex-Mormon. You can hear what I mean by that day three. That's a preview, all right? Now, my background with Mormons and Mormonism is a little strange. Had a really good friend in middle school and high school who was a Mormon. His father was an elder in the local Mormon church. Kurt knows this guy, and I don't know exactly how he is now, but back then, to say he was one of the worst human beings we knew would be an understatement. And it wasn't that he was evil. It was just that he was so amoral with everything he did. I never held it against Mormons because of him, because you just knew that was just him. But then again, he was not a shining exemplar of that faith. He and I were pretty good friends, and you're saying good company corrupts, or bad company corrupts good morals. Well, yeah, he got me into a lot of trouble. We had a lot of fun. And his faith was not something he was very public about. He drank Cokes, sweet tea. His dad had a pretty substantial liquor cabinet hidden behind the cereal. So You know, they had Mormon get-togethers at his house. He just put the Fruit Loops in front of it so no one dug behind it and saw everything else. And, you know, if I had to say what were Mormons just coming away from that, I would not have had a good idea because they were not vocal Mormons. Now, fast forward when he gets out of high school, and I'm out of high school, we both do a year of college, and then he goes and says, I want to do my two-year mission. And I'm thinking, you're going to do your two-year mission. And he did not seem like he was the devout type, but he did. We started arguing over religion then. And he went to Mexico for his mission, but he called the local missionaries who lived in Defuniak and sicked the missionaries on me. And so one day I had heard a knock at the door, and it's two elders who are young, you know, young men from the Mormon church in town who are here to talk to me about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I think, well, this is going to be good. So they come in and we sit and argue and talk for about 2 hours. And the way I handled it, I would not handle it that way today, but being young and wanting to win an argument, you do that. So they never visited again. Fast forward a couple of years later, and we get a call from a private investigator one day. I have a pretty rough family history with my father's side, and I think private investigator, they're looking for Dad. But they're not. They're looking actually for me and for my sister, and they said, you have a half-brother you've never met who's traced you down to here. It's when I lived in Marianna. And he's wanting to reconnect with his family, and he's just, you know, he has nobody. His mother has died from cancer. Can't find your father. And this private investigator's like, we can't find him anywhere. And I'm going, you know, we didn't know where he was either. So, but this young man just really wants a family, really wants to meet you. So we think it's like, you know, young man coming home trying to reconnect. Well, he's a Mormon. And not only is he a Mormon, he's about to go on his two-year mission. And kind of what they do when you join the church is they give you a list of people to evangelize, and your family is first on the list. Usually that's the last people we go to talk to, but that's the first you go to talk to as a Mormon. So he had to reconnect with his family and try to evangelize them into the Mormon church. So the day Benjamin was born, I met my half-brother for the first and only time so far in person. As he came to the hospital and, you know, had to meet my son and half-brother, we spent about 2 weeks where he would go between here and Defuniak. And in the process of that, he started talking about his Mormon faith and what he wanted to do in life with it. So, once again, bringing kind of back into my memory a lot of these Mormon distinctives and having to talk with somebody about them, what I want to give you is information to be in the situation where when you talk to a Mormon, you're not learning for the first time what they believe. You kind of come settled what you believe versus whatever they're going to say. And I'll tell you a story of why you want to have this settled. Rodney remembers this. We sat down with my half-brother and asked him, what are you going to do on your two-year mission? You've seen the guys bicycling and walking. And if you need, they have a truck. So they're real big over there. They got a truck they ride around in. No more bicycles. But what are you going to do on your two-year mission? And he said, well, I'm going to knock on people's doors and talk to them about Christianity. And I said, well, what would you tell a person when you knock on the door and they say, I'm a Christian, I already go to church? He said, I'm going to tell them I'm a Christian too, and I believe like they do. And I said, but you don't, do you? And Rodney remembers this. He said, well, I guess not. And I said, so you're going to lie to him? He said, no, I'm not going to lie to him. I said, hold on, do you think this person you're talking to is a Christian? He said, no. I said, do you think they really believe the same thing you do? He said, no. I said, you think you're going to heaven and they're not? They said, that's correct. And I said, so you're going to lie to somebody, get into their house, tell them that you believe like they do when you don't, and then try to trick them to your belief. And he said, I guess that's what I'm going to do. So, you know, I just want you to know what the game is before you get to that point, what they believe before you get to the point, because they start with common ground and then they change the ground. And I want you to have common ground with what you really believe and not with what they believe. Don't let them say there's common ground really between the two things. So we'll get into that. And hopefully by the end of 3 days, you'll be able to say, okay, next time they knock on the door, we're going to have a friendly chat. So, real quick, let's run through the history of Mormonism. Let's talk about where it came from. If you look at point number one, America, after the American Revolutionary War, experienced a great amount of change. It had broken culturally with the continent, and the pure American ideals started bubbling to the surface. What made America so different than Europe? These things started bubbling out, and you had the Second Great Awakening. Second Great Awakening goes from about 1790 to 1820. It was in different regions at different times, so it wasn't like the First Great Awakening where it was mainly a Puritan revival. The First Great Awakening was in the 1730s, 1740s, and it was Puritan, Presbyterian, Congregationalist pastors like Jonathan Edwards who were preaching a very doctrinal gospel, a very Calvinistic gospel. And so revival would hit churches, and churches would have members come in, and those members would come just like any other member. They would come, they would meet with the pastor, profess faith, show evidence, this is to be catechized and ingested into church membership. It was how church had always grown and always gone for the Puritans. So the First Great Awakening did not change the structure of the church. It just increased the numbers. After the First Great Awakening, Enlightenment thought started permeating the churches. A lot of the New England clergy became, in that day, liberals, universalists, Unitarians, and really started embracing more deism than Christianity. Well, in that type of setting, they kept their institutional churches. And so you had dead churches full of people who had never heard the gospel, or if they had, they'd responded, but their clergy might not believe it. In that environment, the Second Great Awakening broke out, especially up in New York. You had preachers like Charles Finney and a lot of others who would go around and yell at the congregation, great passion and intensity, and they would whip people up into a fervor, and that's where you started having altar calls and the anxious bench. And so at the end of the service, you had, you know, all these people crying and running down the aisle and praying. It was a very individualistic revival because people, individuals, were meeting God directly, sometimes legitimately and sometimes not. But what it did to church structure was it subverted the original church structure that was there. And so those people who got into the church would oftentimes immediately assume leadership. They would immediately start working for another revival. These revivals sometimes would take place in big hayfields and be independent of churches, and then churches would form afterwards of people who really didn't know how to run a church. So you had this leveling where the congregation and the clergy were taken out of the mix, and it was just people and God. Second Great Awakening moved throughout the North to the mid-states, all the way to the South. This is where the Baptists and the Methodists really come from in the South. You wonder why there's so many Baptists and Methodists down here. Second Great Awakening. They would go into these frontier areas and start new congregations overnight. At a revival, people would get saved. The next day, it's First Baptist Church. And so you have a lot of these numbers in the South of Baptists and Methodists just from this movement right here. Now, like any other movement in history, it borrows from what's already going on in the world. And one of the really big ideas that was going on in Europe and then moved over to America was called Romanticism. Kurt and I, and this is, you know, Providence right here, Kurt and I were talking about this, not related to Mormons, just last week, and I was asking him questions when I found it out studying for this. I was like, pretty amazing that what we just talked about fed into the church. Romanticism came after the Enlightenment. In the Enlightenment, people loved ration, reason. You could perfect yourself through reason. The next generation of people rejected that, and they went back to nature. Their art shows this movement away from the city to nature, away from industrialization to the more primitive lifestyle. The poets were you know, like Wordsworth, we talked about, just these, what you consider poetry, you know, the brooding, emotional, disgruntled poet is a romantic. That's who the romantics were. They were emo before emo was cool. Romanticism even infected the church. You had individuals looking at the clergy and saying, I don't need their God. I've got God by myself, you know, and having this movement of people and God meeting each other without a church structure being pivotal to this. So Romantic Second Great Awakening really came together to produce this purely American individualistic religious mishmash in the North. And you had something called the burned over districts up North. It's where people couldn't even go and do revivals anymore. They'd walk into a town and everyone would say, "We've been revived about 20 times. There's no lost people here." Now, how real and deep their religion was is another question, but they had been basically shook up so much they were done being shook up. So in upstate New York, you have this burned over district, you have the legacy of revivals, and you have this individualistic expression of faith where it's just me and God, and I don't need anybody else. That was kind of the American religious environment that Joseph Smith comes out of. Go to the next slide. Got Joseph Smith, in the 1820s, he had a vision in upstate New York. Now, this comes right out of the Second Great Awakening. He goes into the woods, and he's praying. And he has a vision of God the Father and God the Son. And he's praying because he's in great turmoil, and he says, "Which church should I join? I don't know which denomination to join." And you think about it. They've all been up there having revivals, competing, arguing over who gets the sheep, you know? And here's this young man who really is just saying, "Which church should I join?" And in the middle of this has this purported vision, and God tells him, "Well, they're all corrupt. They're all wrong. In fact, right after the death of the apostles, they all went astray, they apostatized, and I'm going to restore the true church through you." So in 1827, in a hillside in upstate New York, he finds some golden plates. An angel shows him where they are. He had tried to get them before, but had been prevented. But this time, he gets these golden plates. Now, these golden plates were supposed to have the record on them of ancient civilizations. And he gets the golden plates and takes them back to his house. I'm going to get to what he does with them in just a minute. We're going to keep marching through the history. In 1830, the Book of Mormon is published, first edition. Now, the Mormons are still in upstate New York, and when the Book of Mormon's published, about 3,000 or 4,000 people start joining the Mormon Church. At that time, it's called the Church of Christ. It is not called Latter-day Saints or anything like that. That comes later. Well, the locals realize he's kind of got something weird going on here because he has an extra Bible that they don't have. And so they start bringing persecution on the Mormons. And the Mormons leave. And so they go in 1831 to Ohio. Now, Ohio at this time is, you know, we think Ohio is in the east. The American mindset at this time, Ohio is the west. And as settlers branch out and move west, you're going to see the Mormon church moves west with them. So 1831 Ohio, they're there for 7 years, and same pattern. Persecution, infighting, the Mormons get removed. So in 1838, they're in Missouri. In 1839, Illinois. In 1844, Joseph Smith dies in a gunfight in Illinois. That's one of the strange parts about the story is Joseph Smith dies while shooting a pistol at a mob coming at the jail he is being held in. In 1844, after Joseph Smith's death, the Mormons move out to Utah Territory. And so that's the basic chronology of the founding of the Mormon Church and how it ends up in its, we call it traditional homeland today, of Utah. Now, next slide, let's get to Mormon scripture. There's a big book right there, and if you read the spine, they've got the Holy Bible, KJV version, the Book of Mormon, which we're about to get to where it came from, and they've got these two other ones. Now, the Book of Mormon is mainly narrative history. If you read it, you're going to read a story. And it's recorded by these characters in the story who are passing it on to other people. You don't get a lot of the weird feelings you would get from some Mormon stuff from the Book of Mormon. It's just, it's like history. It's just written like history. You start asking, where is temple marriage? Where is a celestial, you know, marriage? Where is the priesthood of Melchizedek? Where are all these Mormon beliefs that maybe some of you have heard about? It's not in the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon is one they pass out because it's tame. It sounds like the Bible. It looks like the Bible. It reads kind of like the Bible. And it's not going to say anything really crazy like Jesus is just a glorified man who physically descended from Elohim, who's just a glorified man who physically descended from another god. You don't get that from the Book of Mormon. You get that from Doctrine and Covenants and the Pearl of Great Price. That is really where a lot of their foundational teaching comes from that is completely apart from Christianity, from those two last books. So Book of Mormon, when they hand it out to you and say, read it and see if you like it, you're going to read it and you're going to say, it sounds like the Old Testament. And it does sound like the Old Testament. You're not going to find a lot of weird stuff in it. The stuff you're going to find that goes completely against Christianity is in the last two books. So we ask the question, what is the Book of Mormon? And in this next slide, we're going to start going through that. Now that's the history of where Mormonism started, came from. The main question now is, what is the Book of Mormon? Because this, I think once you see this, you're going to see something very interesting about how this all operates for them. All right, I told you that Joseph Smith looked into a hillside and saw golden plates through a magic seeing stone, and an angel led him eventually in 1827 to recover these golden plates from the hill. Now, what you don't know is Joseph Smith was actually called into a court in 1826 for treasure hunting. Treasure hunting back then was not like we might do today where we find an old map of sunken Spanish ships in the Gulf and actually get oxygen and dive down there and try to find gold. Treasure hunting was a spiritual, like, almost like a cultic act back then. You would take a magic stone and look through it and look through hills and say, I see a treasure. Or you'd walk around in old Indian villages and look for treasure through a magic seeing stone. Sometimes they'd put them in a hat and it would help them see where the treasures were. Joseph Smith was paid to find treasure. He did not find it, and the guy sued him in court because he was a false treasure hunter. That's before he finds these golden plates. That's in the records of New York. Smith used magic stones and would look through them and said he could see golden plates. An angel told him, don't open that, don't go in there. Finally, 1827, the angel says, dig it up. He takes it home, and what he does is he uses the stones and he sets them up in some type of, I don't know if it was, you know, like glasses or if it's like a magnifying glass set up, but these magic stones, sometimes people are confused. They don't know if they were the Urim and Thummim that he talks about or if the Urim and Thummim from the Old Testament, if he claimed to have received them from an angel, but he used this combination of stuff to translate the golden plates. Now you will say, translate them, what were they written in? Good question. Reformed Egyptian. Not reformed like our reformed, but reformed Egyptian. The problem is there's no recorded language called reformed Egyptian. It's not to stop Mormon apologists who say, well, this is like a hieratic, which is a shorthand Egyptian hieroglyphic. We just call it reformed Egyptian to make it, you know, because it's not old style Egyptian. Regardless, we have a fragment here written down that supposedly contains real symbols on the golden plates. And it's called, if you'll notice it, it's called characters, C-A-R-A-C-T-E-R-S. The Book of Mormon is notorious and the original manuscripts are misspellings. Well, even the handwriting of, I guess that's Joseph Smith's handwriting, misspelled characters. And you have these characters written out. They brought them to a guy and said, attest that these are true. And the guy said, whoever gave you these is a huckster. Well, when they went back to Joseph Smith, he said, well, he attested them. And the guy's like, I didn't attest to them. Whoever is doing this is trying to trick people. Egyptologists today will look at that and say, that's some of them look like some letters of Akkadian, Egyptian, other Middle Eastern languages, but that's nothing different than if I asked Carrie to just draw Chinese characters because he's eaten at, you know, Panda Buffet recently. He could probably give me a couple. The stuff up there means nothing, and it really isn't cool. But that's supposed to be a sample of what the golden plate language looked like, this reformed Egyptian. You've got, that's called the Anthon transcript, by the way, up there. Smith would read the golden plates in a room by himself with sheets around him. No one else could see them. Some people complained, so he's like, okay, I'll let three of you see them. More people complained, or I'll let eight more. So 11 people saw the plates, but they were not allowed to take them out of there. When he would read a passage, he would just say it in English, and a guy outside the room would copy it down. That was Martin Harris, and then later Oliver Cowdery. Martin actually took the first 100 pages home to his wife, who then hid them, and those were never recovered. So the rest of the Book of Mormon doesn't contain whatever was in those first 111 pages. The wife said something like, if this is from God, then tell, you know, then tell Joseph to tell God to rewrite the first 100 pages. We'll see if they match. Because she didn't trust this. Well, wouldn't you know it, those 111 pages just went missing. And Joseph said something about how it's been corrupted anyway, don't worry about it. So that's how the Book of Mormon was written down. Now you're going to say, what is in the Book of Mormon? The next slide we'll start talking about that. This is what's interesting. The Book of Mormon is a record of God's dealings with the indigenous American population. Indians. Not all the Indians, just some of them. The Babylonians, you know, destroyed Jerusalem in 586 BC, and the Book of Mormon records two groups of Jews, the Nephites and the Lamanites. They ran from the Babylonian destruction to Egypt, and then they floated across the Atlantic Ocean and landed in like North South America and Central America. They set up two different kingdoms, and those kingdoms began to fight each other. Well, part of the interesting history of this is that the Lamanites and the Nephites knew about Jesus 580 years before he was born. And they talk about Jesus. So you read the Book of Mormon, and this is supposed to happen like in 400 BC, and they're talking about Jesus dying on the cross. And when people say Jewish people didn't know about this, the Mormon response is these Jewish people did, because they were the true Jewish people. The other ones had already left, and they were hard-hearted. They didn't care about Jesus. And so these two kingdoms have a bunch of wars, and that's what the Book of Mormon records. That's why it's history. People fighting, people killing each other, people testifying that so-and-so is true, and then God saying good testimony when someone kills them and their head keeps talking after it's been cut off. You've also got a period of time where Jesus, after he resurrects from the dead, comes to these kingdoms and preaches to them and sets up a truly Christian kingdom for about 200 years, at which time it collapses. So, yeah, Jesus in America. Jesus and the Indians. And then you have these people called the Jaredites, who were supposed to have lived here for thousands and thousands of years before even them, and they escaped the Tower of Babel. And so it just reads like a fantasy novel, a giant story of kingdoms fighting and miraculous things happening. And I mean, it, you know, I've never been able to read very far into it, but I'm sure it's a very entertaining read for narrative sake. But you get into it and you just think, Jewish people in America. That's why today when I asked our administrator, I said, do you know where this book took place? He said, no, Israel, I don't know. And I said, I pointed to his globe, I was like, Central America. He said, what? I said, yeah, exactly, what? You know, who... It's hard to believe that Jewish people lived in Central America for about 800 years and disappeared while leaving a big stack of golden plates in upstate New York for Joseph Smith to discover. It's very tough to get. That's not the first thing they knock on your door and ask. Do you want to know about American Indians hearing about Jesus? And you'd say, didn't know they heard about him. But that's what's contained in the Book of Mormon, the first of the three big Mormon scriptures. Next slide, Carrie. It's got in it references to steel. They're steel swords. Mormon apologists were asked about this. They said there's no record of steel being used in the Mesoamerican cultures. What is that? They said, well, it's just an analogy. In English, it's steel, but I'm sure in the original language it meant something else. They said, no, wait. And they started reading the passage. It talks about the handle, the jewels in the sword. Very ornate description, and Mormon apologists just say, "Yeah, don't worry about it." Or they'll say, it will be found eventually. Elephants. Elephants in Central America. We found any elephant bones in Central America yet? Not yet. Wheat. Wheat, you know, was not grown over here. Horses. Horses came over with the conquistadors. They were not here before then. Brass, also not. You know, Indians weren't into metallurgy. Swords, other items completely absent from the historical and archaeological evidence from this time period. If you ask Mormon apologists, where is the evidence for two giant empires down there fighting these massive wars that somehow logistically got to upstate New York for their final battle? They can't tell you specific evidence, but they will say, well, we found evidence. But, you know, it's never real specific. Joseph Smith said of the Book of Mormon, it's the most correct of any book. So in a Mormon's mindset, it is even more correct than your Bible. So you've got a book patently false from archaeological records. Linguistic evidence is lacking. Etymology was a big thing in the 1830s. It was cool. You wanted to go see some stuff that guys had stolen from pyramids over there, and they would ship it off to America and travel around showing all the simple farm folk, you know, mummies and stuff like that, and people wanted to see it. There was a big interest in spiritism and magic during this time, and anything Egyptian looked magical. Well, it was either Illinois or Missouri, one of those places, when the Mormons were there, an exhibit came through town. Joseph Smith saw a scrap of a book. He said, that's the Book of Abraham. Buy it. So he convinced a family to buy it from the traveling Egyptian relic displayer, and he translated it. It's the Book of Abraham. The problem is, after Joseph Smith's death, the Mormon church split into at least three factions, and one faction got that scrap and kept it till this century, and Egyptologists got it from them and studied it, and they said, this is not the Book of Abraham. This is not Reformed Egyptian, which doesn't exist. This is a scrap from the Book of the Dead. So it was found to be a fraud. There's no linguistic evidence that Joseph Smith read Reformed Egyptian or could translate Reformed Egyptian. He just managed to live in backwater areas of America near the time that the Rosetta Stone was discovered before anyone could come and challenge him. Historical written evidence is lacking. As you know, none of these Mesoamerican cultures wrote down their history in any way that could ever validate Jewish presence in the New World before colonization. Archaeological evidence is lacking. They try to say the Olmec civilization in Mexico are the Jaredites, but once again, the Olmecs had their own civilization that we can trace back. They were not Jewish. And a big one is genetic evidence. We know that American Indians have zero Jewish genetic features. It's not like it's close. I mean, you know, genetic evidence, zero. And so when you look at things I would want to look at to see if something really happened. Things that the Bible is attacked on but can stand up on, that's lacking for the Book of Mormon. It does not have a defensible position. You know, with the Bible, you can hear skeptics saying, well, the Old Testament is a myth. But the more we learn about the ancient Near East, the more we learn this has solid roots in history. Whether it's the chariot wheels they find underwater near Egypt that have a certain number of spokes that only matches one dynasty, and that dynasty is the one suspected that Moses led the children of Israel out during, or whether it is the Canaanite kingdoms sending request to the king of Egypt, we need help, and their loan word was the Ibri, which sounds like Hebrew. The Ibri are invading us. They've already taken out this town and this town, which follows the book of Joshua, and they're coming after this one. We need help. You've got stuff like that where you say something was going on in the ancient world, and when the Bible says this, we see a correlation of events around the same time period in the same place. Nothing in the Book of Mormon like that. You can't look at the Book of Mormon even in one place and say we know where history and the Book of Mormon meet. With the Bible, you got 586 BC, the Babylonians write about destroying Jerusalem. Jerusalem writes about Jerusalem being destroyed, and other countries notice that Jerusalem was destroyed. Nothing like that in Central America for the Nephites or Lamanites. So, what do we have here? Simply put, a book without any proof of its authenticity in origin or in history. And that's the basis of the Mormon religion, and that is the basis of Joseph Smith's prophetic authority. Now, any questions? I know we've covered quite any questions about any of this or anything maybe you want clarified. Andrew.
Where did the other two books come from? Or we can talk about them.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more in detail about distinctive beliefs, but simply put, Joseph Smith, not only did he translate golden plates, he would receive direct revelation. He would be sitting around and praying, I guess, and then he'd bring his elders in and the apostles of the Mormon church. The Lord has just told me, now we're going to do this. And people would say, well, this is opposite of what you said last year. And you'd say, it doesn't matter. God has said it. And so there was no attempt at logic or systematizing it. It was just, this is what God has told me today. And so the Doctrine and Covenants, a lot of that is Joseph Smith and then the guy who takes over from him, Brigham Young, their recorded teachings. The Pearl of Great Price is translated like the Book of Abraham, the Book of Moses that he found from those traveling Egyptian, basically like a traveling circus with a bunch of Egyptian stuff in it. So those other two, like I said, are where you get into a lot of the really weird stuff. The belief that you pre-existed your own body in heaven and God gave you a choice, do you follow me or reject me? And because you decided to follow God, you were born on earth. The belief that one day you can become a god and have your own planet, that's all Doctrines and Covenants and Pearl of Great Price. Book of Mormon doesn't have that in it.
Understand that Joseph Smith was said to be, before he found the golden plate, was said to be like a loose cannon. He was always on these little misadventures and a dreamer and like always into something, and he couldn't hold a job down for very long and stuff like that too.
Yeah, and when he went to court, the woman he eventually married, her father said, you don't have a job and all you do is treasure hunt, so you can't court my... Well, they went and eloped anyway, but that was the reputation he had around town, is that he was a treasure hunter. He would do, which like I said, treasure hunter wasn't let's go look at a map and find buried gold. It was magic. He would do magic tricks, and he would just kind of run around and do this and that. It's not the But of course, you know, and a lot of that stuff, if you ask a Mormon, they'll say, well, that was just said by his enemies. The trial that I mentioned, there are records of that, that he was brought up for doing that. He also, I'm trying to remember the exact details, but there were some financial issues he got into several times during his life. He was no good with money. They tried to make a bank in Missouri, and it flopped within like a month. Ended up owing tons of people money, and that's part of the reason they moved out, is like they had mortgaged all their houses and stuff to this giant bank. It flopped, and he's like, well, creditors are going to take our entire city. Let's go to Illinois. Just not good with money, not good at managing that type of stuff. Throughout his life, there were conflicts over money and management. I mean, that in and of itself is kind of like probably not the greatest religious leader to follow.
And he wasn't martyred, was he?
It was like this. A mob came to the jail to kill him. He fired. I'm not going to get mad at him for that, self-defense. But he died in a gunfight. He jumped out of a window. Well, he shot and jumped out of a window trying to escape that. One of the... and Nick may have more information on this. Is pretty well read in this, but he became a Freemason 2 years before he died, and his last recorded words were, "Lord God, have mercy." But someone else said his last words were, "Lord God, have mercy on me." And what's the Mason line? It's something like a poor son, but it was like a Mason type defense mechanism where you're supposed to be able to use that to keep Masons away from you, because the people who are coming to get him were Masons and he was a Mason. It was supposed to be, listen, stop shooting, I'm a Mason, but he died. Well, the reason why I started with the Book of Mormon as the first thing we talk about, their view of church is almost like the view of Israel, the kingdom. You've got a church functioning as the vehicle of salvation, kind of like the nation of Israel was the vehicle of the covenant under Moses. So, later on, Joseph Smith is going to set up a priesthood called the Melchizedek Priesthood. He's going to say that Peter and John the Baptist came and gave him the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and that he is the true heir of the apostles' authority. Therefore, he declares every other church is invalid. And it's not that they believe the wrong things. He says a lot of the Bible is still true. A lot of it's corrupt. But as far as authority goes, these churches have no authority. Only Joseph Smith's church has the proper authority to dispense ordinances that will save you and give teaching that will make you wise and kind of unlock the kingdom so you can go in. The church is central to salvation in that whole role, and so that's part of the reason he believed that he would restore the true church is not necessarily that the people in it are any better, but they've got the way to salvation. They've got the keys, and they've got the priesthood. No one else has that. That's why they established temples, because, you know, we don't really believe that we have a functioning priesthood at this church. Jesus is our high priest, but we don't have a functioning priesthood. The Mormon church views itself as a functioning priesthood. No, they miraculously got taken into heaven upon completion of the translation. Somebody did somebody asked for dimensions because the dimensions are written down in one of the notes, and they reconstructed what that would weigh. And it was something like 300 pounds. And so you have this giant stack of gold leaves with writing on them, 300 pounds, and Joseph Smith is carrying this thing around to translate it. And, of course, the Mormon explanation was God gave him supernatural strength. That's an easy one. I could have seen that one coming. But they were taken back up into heaven after the completion of it. It's convenient. Yeah, and the one that sticks out to me is in Hebrews 1, and long ago at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. And it's the idea that whatever Jesus said, everything before that, yeah, God was speaking, but this is the final thing he has said. And if you even read the point of the book of Hebrews, it's, you know, the temple's done. Jesus has said it all. Jesus has fixed it all. He's the last thing God said. You know, and that's the hard thing about using that against a moral.